Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, November 20th, 2021, reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today, we will be reading from the following main articles. Aurora's Hinckley High School, Three Shot in Parking Lot, by Sam Tabachnik and Kieran Nicholson. COVID-19, Polis Eases Access to Antibodies, by Meg Wengerter. Rocky Flats, Refuge Foes Appeal Case, by John Aguilar. Rittenhouse Not Guilty, by Michael Tarm, Scott Bauer, and Amy Forlitti, the Associated Press. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Aurora's Hinckley High School, Three Shot in Parking Lot, Second Shooting This Week of Multiple Students, 16-Year-Old Boy Charged, by Sam Tabachnik and Kieran Nicholson, The Denver Post. Aurora, three teens were shot Friday in the parking lot of Hinckley High School, the second time this week that an Aurora high school has seen its students rushed to hospitals with gunshot wounds as city leaders plead for an end to violence. Two of the injured teens are Hinckley students, and the third attends APS Avenues, Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson said during an afternoon news conference. None of the injuries is believed to be life-threatening, she said. Aurora police announced late Friday that a 16-year-old boy was arrested and has been charged with attempted murder. Police did not release the name of the suspect. Wilson said police are sorting out which of the teens are victims and who may be a suspect. These are our kids shooting each other, Wilson said. The Hinckley students who were shot are both 17, a male and a female, and the APS Avenue student is a 16-year-old male, police said. A school security officer returned fire when the shooting started around noon, Wilson said, and applied a tourniquet to one of the wounded students. One of the three was taken by ambulance to a hospital. The other two were self-transported. The shooting, which included multiple people firing weapons, stemmed from a fight in the parking lot, the chief said. Police are investigating whether the incident was related to the drive-by shooting at nearby Aurora Central High School on Monday that left 6 teens wounded. All told, 9 teens were wounded in shootings outside 2 Aurora schools this week. Threats involving 2 more high schools, Rangeview and Gateway, circulated on social media, Wilson said. Everyone in this community should be very angry, Wilson said, pleading with parents to check their kids' phones, rooms, and cars to make sure they are not carrying weapons. Wilson said police located a white pickup that may be related to the shooting. Detectives were questioning 2 people in relation to the shootings Friday afternoon. All Hinckley students were released to their parents, she said, and school officials canceled all after-school activities and athletics. Gail Dominguez, a Hinckley junior, said he saw people running, and at first I thought they were fooling around. Teachers started yelling at students to run, so Dominguez fled the campus and called his mom to tell her he was okay. Sherry Ellis rushed to the school Friday to pick up her grandson. I can only imagine how these kids feel going to school, she said. This is crazy. When is it going to stop? Church volunteers outside the school Friday afternoon passed out bottles of water to concerned parents who gathered behind the yellow crime tape surrounding the campus. Jeremy Conrad, who attends the nearby Calvary Wellspring Church, said he doesn't have any children at the school, but came out because he was concerned for the community. It's a sense of sadness for those who are experiencing pain and those who are threatened by violence, Conrad said. On Monday, 6 teens were shot in a park across the street from Aurora Central High School. All 6 victims, who ranged in age from 14 to 18, were students at Aurora Central High School. None of their wounds was considered life-threatening, but two remained hospitalized. In the wake of that shooting, city and interfaith leaders planned a peace march Friday, but just as they were about to get underway, word of the Hinckley shooting made its way to organizers. The organizers let the city know they were postponing the event, Aurora officials tweeted. John Kellner, the district attorney whose jurisdiction covers parts of Aurora, said in a statement Friday that our community rightly is demanding an end to this violence, and we will stand with them in using every tool we have to prosecute aggressively anyone connected to these attacks on students. Governor Jared Polis offered thoughts and prayers to the victims during a news conference on Colorado's COVID-19 situation on Friday, and he said the state is working on initiatives to reduce violence. Aurora has seen a spike in youth violence this year that has drawn attention from city leaders, community members, and law enforcement. After Friday's shooting, at least 49 teens, ages 13 to 19, have been shot and injured this year, compared with 33 in 2020, according to Aurora police figures. 7 teens have been killed in Aurora this year, up from 6 in 2020 and 5 the year prior. Reporters Meg Wingerter and Elise Schmelzer contributed to this report. COVID-19. Polis eases access to antibodies. Metro Denver counties consider mask mandates, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Starting next week, Coloradans with COVID-19 who are at high risk of developing severe illness won't need a doctor's referral for antibody treatments meant to keep them out of hospitals, Governor Jared Polis announced Friday afternoon. Polis has made expanding access to monoclonal antibodies a pillar of the state's strategy to avoid running out of hospital beds in the coming weeks, along with opening more beds and encouraging all adults to get a booster shot. But the governor has resisted reinstating public health measures such as mask mandates or capacity limits on businesses, despite calls from local public health officials to take more aggressive action. On Monday, the health departments representing Jefferson, Adams, and Arapahoe counties, which have lobbied Polis to issue a new mask mandate for public indoor spaces, will consider enacting their own. Hospitalizations for COVID-19 in Colorado dropped slightly Friday to 1,518, but facilities remained stressed. 2 in every 5 hospitals reporting to the state expected to be short on intensive care beds in the next week, and 45% said they were facing a shortage of workers. The virus remains widespread in the state, less than a week out from Thanksgiving gatherings. About 1 in 62 Coloradans is infected with COVID-19, and the rate rises to 1 in 38 when counting only unvaccinated people. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, recommended vaccine boosters for all adults Friday afternoon, essentially bringing the rest of the country in line with what Colorado and several other states already had declared. About 31% of fully vaccinated Colorado adults have received a booster. Polis, speaking from the Colorado State Emergency Operations Center on Friday, acknowledged a trade-off between making it as easy as possible to get antibody treatments and allowing some people who don't qualify to slip through. Monoclonal antibodies are lab-created versions of proteins the body produces to help fight the SARS-CoV-2 virus and can reduce the risk of hospitalization by about 70% if taken early. They have been earmarked for people at high risk of severe illness from COVID-19. The state doesn't have enough doses for everyone who tests positive, but the honor system generally has worked well during the pandemic, and people without a doctor they regularly see aren't getting any antibody treatments now, he said. We did this before in the phased introduction of the vaccine, Polis said. To be eligible for antibody treatment, people must show they have tested positive for COVID-19 and report that their symptoms began within the past 10 days. If a person is sick enough to be hospitalized, it's too late for monoclonal antibodies to help. They also must attest that they have one of the following criteria: 65 or older, obese or overweight, pregnant, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, compromised immune system, heart disease or high blood pressure, chronic lung disease, including moderate or severe asthma, sickle cell disease, neurodevelopmental disorders such as cerebral palsy or complex genetic conditions, reliance on medical technology such as a breathing tube or a feeding tube. Paulus encouraged anyone with symptoms to get tested so that they can get treatment in the first days of their illness if they qualify. Monoclonal antibody treatment is only as good as people knowing they're positive, he said. Jeffco, Tri-County, consider mask orders. Paulus dismissed the idea of reinstating a statewide mask mandate or requiring proof of vaccination in potentially crowded settings, as multiple Denver area health departments had asked him to do in a letter sent last week. He described wearing masks in public as an act of decency to protect unvaccinated people and others at high risk of disease, but asked the public not to demonize those who reach different conclusions about whether slowing the virus spread is worth accepting a mandate. I don't think the motives of either side should be called into question, he said. The data consistently has pointed to mask wearing as effective strategy to limit the spread of COVID-19, although not as effective as widespread vaccination. Jefferson County Public Health sent a separate letter to Paulus on Thursday, citing 16 COVID-19 deaths among county residents in the previous week, and announced that its Board of Health will consider a local mask mandate Monday. The Tri-County Health Department's Board of Health is scheduled to vote Monday afternoon on an order that would require masks be worn in all public indoor spaces in Adams and Arapahoe counties. Along the Front Range, Boulder and Larimer counties have indoor mask mandates in place. Governor Paulus, we all need to do more to address the trends we are seeing currently, and that will most likely surge in the coming weeks with holiday travel and movement indoors, the Jeffco Board of Health said in its letter. Trends are going in the wrong direction, and we implore you to take additional mitigation steps immediately before anyone else loses their life unnecessarily. Finding more hospital beds. Paulus's other main strategy to avoid overrunning hospitals is to increase the number of beds available. He has called on the state's hospitals and nursing homes to find a combined 500 acute care and step-down beds in the next 20 days. The problem isn't a shortage of beds or rooms to put them, but of skilled people to care for the patients in them. The state staffing fusion center is working to find nurses and others for those beds, Paulus said. The Federal Emergency Management Agency sent a team to help out at Parkview Medical Center in Pueblo and coordinated another group that's going to Fort Collins next week. About 20 nurses, respiratory therapists, and others who work for the U.S. Department of Defense will deploy to UC Health Poudre Valley Hospital. As of Thursday morning, UC Health was caring for 377 COVID-19 patients, including 100 in its northern Colorado hospitals, said Kevin Unger, president and CEO at Poudre Valley Hospital and UC Health Medical Center of the Rockies in Loveland. The team's arrival will free up some staff members to help out at nearby hospitals, in addition to easing the pressure on Poudre Valley, he said. We are so grateful that this team will assist us in providing exceptional care in northern Colorado, he said in a news release. We anticipate this additional and other plans we already have in the works will help make a significant difference. Rocky Flats, Refuge Foes Appeal Case by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. Calling it the last and best chance to close this refuge, a group opposed to the use of the former Rocky Flats nuclear weapons manufacturing site as a wildlife refuge open to hikers and cyclists, took their case to a federal appeals court Friday. The complaint, filed by the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, along with several neighborhood groups, seeks to overturn U.S. District Chief Judge Philip A. Brimmer's decision in July to dismiss the plaintiff's lawsuit against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. My clients don't believe the significant environmental issues related to residual plutonium contamination at Rocky Flats have been adequately reviewed by Fish and Wildlife, Attorney Randall Weiner said this week. Specifically, the appeal states that the federal agency did not comply with the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act in opening the refuge to the public 3 years ago and building a trail network there. It cites a 2011 email from a former manager of Rocky Flats suggesting that public trails on the east side of the property avoid the plutonium plume in the downwind portion of the refuge. Plaintiffs also claim that a portion of the property where trails will be located wasn't purchased until 2012 and was never assessed for radioactive contamination. Claire O'Brien, administrator at the Boulder-based Peace and Justice Center, said it's unsafe for people to recreate there. It's not safe to have any levels of plutonium that could affect people, children, and dogs, she said. Dave Lucas, refuge manager for Rocky Flats, said Fish and Wildlife could not comment on ongoing litigation. There are 11 miles of trails on the refuge, where for more than 40 years, triggers for nuclear warheads were assembled before the weapons plant was raided by federal agents in 1989 and closed a few years later. It took a decade and $7 billion to clean up the inner core of the 5,200-acre refuge north of Arvada, which was laced with chemical contaminants from years of making bombs. That 1,300-acre inner core, called the Central Operable Unit, remains indefinitely off-limits to the public. Rocky Flats made headlines in 2019 when a plutonium hotspot was detected on the east edge of the refuge along the Indiana Street fence line. The soil sample had a reading of 264 picocuries per gram of soil, a level 5 times higher than the standard established by the federal government at the time Rocky Flats was cleaned up. But dozens of other soil samples taken in the same area, as well as in other parts of the refuge, have tested well within government-defined acceptable risk thresholds for the deadly substance. Rocky Flats is home to 239 migratory and resident wildlife species, including prairie falcons, deer, elk, coyotes, songbirds, and the threatened Preble's Meadow jumping mouse. Rocky Flats detractors have not had much luck fighting the refuge since it opened to the public. Just 2 months ago, another federal judge dismissed a lawsuit that the town of Superior had filed with similar complaints about a lack of review of environmental concerns at the site. Last week, Superior said it would not appeal that ruling, according to a story in the Daily Camera. This past summer, a judge denied an emergency motion designed to stop Boulder from contributing money to the construction of an underpass connecting trails in Boulder and Boulder County with trails in Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge, part of the Rocky Mountain Greenway Trail that eventually will link several wildlife refuges on the Front Range, including two ponds, Rocky Mountain Arsenal and Rocky Flats, with Rocky Mountain National Park. There is not yet a visitor center at Rocky Flats, and Lucas said there is no date certain for when one might be built. Rittenhouse, not guilty. Gunman who killed two is acquitted of all charges. By Michael Tarm, Scott Bauer, and Amy Forlitti, The Associated Press. Kenosha, Wisconsin. Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of all charges Friday after pleading self-defense in the deadly Kenosha shootings that became a flashpoint in the debate over guns, vigilantism, and racial injustice in the U.S. Rittenhouse, 18, began to choke up, fell forward toward the defense table, and then hugged one of his attorneys as he heard a court clerk recite not guilty 5 times. A sheriff's deputy whisked him out a back door. He wants to get on with his life, defense attorney Mark Richards said. He has a huge sense of relief for what the jury did to him today. He wishes none of this ever happened. But as he said when he testified, he did not start this. The verdict in the politically combustible case was met with anger and disappointment from those who saw Rittenhouse as a vigilante and a wannabe cop, and relief and a sense of vindication from those who regarded him as a patriot who took a stand against lawlessness and exercised his Second Amendment right to carry a gun and to defend himself. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, the longtime civil rights leader, said the verdict throws into doubt the safety of people who protest in support of black Americans. "It seems to me that it's open season on human rights demonstrators," he said. Rittenhouse was charged with homicide, attempted homicide, and reckless endangering for killing two men and wounding a third with a semi-automatic rifle in the summer of 2020 during a tumultuous night of protests over the shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake, by a white Kenosha police officer. Rittenhouse, a then 17-year-old former police youth cadet, said he went to Kenosha to protect property from rioters, but that he came under attack and feared for his life. He is white, as were those he shot. The anonymous jury, whose racial makeup was not disclosed by the court but appeared to be overwhelmingly white, deliberated for close to 3 days. President Joe Biden called for calm, saying that although the outcome of the case will leave many Americans feeling angry and concerned, myself included, we must acknowledge that the jury has spoken. Former President Donald Trump, who at the time of the shooting said it appeared Rittenhouse had been very violently attacked, issued a statement Friday congratulating Rittenhouse on the verdict, adding, "If that's not self-defense, nothing is." Rittenhouse could have gotten life in prison if found guilty on the most serious charge, first-degree intentional homicide, or what some other states call first-degree murder. Two other charges each carried over 60 years behind bars. Kenosha County District Attorney Michael Gravely said his office respects the jury's decision, and he asked the public to accept the verdicts peacefully and not resort to violence. Before the verdict was announced, Democratic Governor Tony Evers said 500 National Guard members stood ready in case of trouble. But hours after the jury came back, there were no signs of major protests or unrest in Kenosha. As he released the jurors, Circuit Judge Bruce Schroeder assured them the court would take every measure to keep them safe. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, who is black and a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, denounced the outcome. He, as many civil rights activists did, saw a racial double standard at work in the case. "Over the last few weeks, many dreaded the outcome we just witnessed," Barnes said. "The presumption of innocence until proven guilty is what we should expect from our judicial system, but that standard is not always applied equally. We have seen so many black and brown youths killed, only to be put on trial posthumously, while the innocence of Kyle Rittenhouse was virtually demanded by the judge." Other political figures on the right welcomed the verdict and condemned the case brought against Rittenhouse. Mark McCloskey, who got in trouble with the law when he and his wife waved a rifle and a handgun at Black Lives Matter protesters marching past his St. Louis home in 2020, said the verdict shows that people have a right to defend themselves from a mob. He is now a Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Missouri. 15 minutes after the verdicts, the National Rifle Association tweeted the text of the Second Amendment. The bloodshed in Kenosha took place during a summer of sometimes violent protests set off across the U.S. by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and other cases involving the police use of force against black people. Rittenhouse went to Kenosha from his home in nearby Antioch, Illinois, after businesses were ransacked and burned in the nights that followed Blake's shooting. He joined other armed civilians on the streets, carrying a weapon authorities said was purchased illegally for him because he was underage. Bystander and drone video captured most of the frenzied chain of events that followed. Rittenhouse killed Joseph Rosenbaum, 36, then shot to death protester Anthony Huber, 26, and wounded demonstrator Gage Grosskreutz, now 28. Prosecutors portrayed Rittenhouse as a wannabe soldier who had gone looking for trouble that night and was responsible for creating a dangerous situation in the first place by pointing his rifle at demonstrators. But Rittenhouse testified, "I didn't do anything wrong. I defended myself." Breaking into sobs at one point, he told the jury he opened fire after Rosenbaum chased him and made a grab for his gun. He said he was afraid his rifle was going to be wrestled away and used to kill him. Huber was killed after hitting Rittenhouse in the head or neck with a skateboard, and Grosskreutz was shot after approaching with his own pistol in hand. Under questioning from the prosecution, Grosskreutz said he had his hands raised as he closed in on Rittenhouse and didn't intend to shoot the young man. Prosecutor Thomas Binger asked Grosskreutz why he didn't shoot first. "That's not the kind of person that I am. That's not why I was out here," he said. "It's not who I am, and definitely not somebody I would want to become." But during cross-examination, Rittenhouse defense attorney Cora Kurafisis asked, "It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him, that he fired, right?" "Correct," Grosskreutz replied. The defense also presented a photo showing Grosskreutz pointing the gun at Rittenhouse, who was on the ground with his rifle pointed up at Grosskreutz. Grosskreutz, under follow-up questioning from the prosecutor, said he did not intend to point his weapon at Rittenhouse. After the verdict, Huber's parents, Karen Bloom and John Huber, said the outcome sends the unacceptable message that armed civilians can show up in any town, incite violence, and use the danger they have created to justify shooting people in the street. Rittenhouse's mother, Wendy, seated near her son on a courtroom bench, gasped in delight, cried, and hugged others around her. Richards, the defense attorney, said Rittenhouse wants to be a nurse and that he is in counseling for post-traumatic stress disorder and will probably move away because it's too dangerous for him to continue to live in the area. Going in, many legal experts said they believed the defense had the advantage because of provisions favorable to Rittenhouse in Wisconsin's self-defense law and video showing him being chased at key moments. Testimony from some of the prosecution's own witnesses also seemed to buttress his claim of self-defense. Senate up next. House okays $2 trillion social climate bill by Alan Fromm, The Associated Press. Washington. A fractious House handed President Joe Biden a marquee victory Friday by approving an approximately $2 trillion social and environmental bill as Democrats cast aside disputes that for months had stalled the measure and had hampered efforts to sell their priorities to voters. Lawmakers approved the legislation 220 to 213 as every Democrat but one backed it, overcoming unanimous Republican opposition. The measure now heads to the Senate, where changes are certain and disputes between cost-conscious Democratic moderates and progressives who seek bold policy changes will flare anew. For the moment, Democrats were happy to shake off a dispiriting period of off-year election setbacks, tumbling Biden poll numbers, and public disgruntlement over inflation, stalled supply chains, and the pandemic. All that and the party's nasty internal bickering have left voters with little idea of how the legislation might help them, polls have shown. Above all, it puts us on the path to build our economy back better than before by rebuilding the backbone of America, working people and the middle class, Biden said in a statement. He told reporters at the White House he expected the legislation to take a while to move through the Senate, but declared, "I will sign it," period. The legislation, among the most expensive in years, is remarkable for its reach. It rewrites tax, health care, environment, education, housing, and other policies, shoring up low and middle income families, helping the elderly, and combating climate change. Most of it would be paid for with tax boosts on the country's highest earners, biggest corporations, and companies doing business abroad. That includes new surtaxes on people earning over $10 million annually and a corporate minimum tax. Because of its size, scope, and status as a symbol of what Democrats stand for, each party thinks the package will help in next year's midterm elections, when Republicans have a solid chance at capturing House and Senate control. "Hey, hey, goodbye," GOP lawmakers sang, taunting Democrats during the vote. Republicans call the measure a waste of money that will worsen budget deficits, overheat an inflation-battered economy, and show voters that Democrats can't resist ever larger government. Democrats see the 2,100-page legislation as overdue and long-lasting help for a vast swath of the nation. "The bill will be the pillar of health and financial security in America," said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California. "If you are a parent, a senior, a child, a worker, if you are an American, this bill is for you." Build Back Better Democrats embracing and jumping with glee at the front of the chamber as the roll call wound down. That's the name Biden has given the bill, a companion piece to his other domestic priority, the bipartisan $1 trillion package of broadband, road, and other infrastructure projects he signed into law this week. in Congress's latest dose of partisan bitterness. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, had delayed the latest bill's expected approval Thursday when he unleashed an 8-hour, 32-minute diatribe against the legislation, the president, and Democrats. McCarthy glared as Democrats booed and groaned during what became the longest speech in House history, remarks that included personal insults aimed at Pelosi. As minority leader in 2018, she held the previous record, speaking for 8 hours and 7 minutes about immigration. "I don't know if it's a farewell tour," McCarthy said of recent trips to Europe by Pelosi, who some think may be serving her last term in Congress. "If it is, I want a T-shirt." Most of the bill's costs come from mountains of new spending, although there are also hundreds of billions in tax credits for encouraging certain goals. It has more than $500 billion for clean energy projects, plus tax incentives for utilities turning to less polluting fuels and people buying electric vehicles. There's money for child care, job training, housing, free preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds, in-home care for seniors, and new hearing benefits for Medicare recipients. People and the government, too, would save money from new curbs on prescription drug prices, although the provisions are modest compared to tougher requirements most Democrats preferred. There would be extended tax credits for families with children, for some low-earning workers, and for people purchasing private health coverage. In language that helped win support from lawmakers from high-cost coastal states, the bill would increase federal deductions people can take for state and local taxes. The provision, which largely would benefit affluent earners, would cost above $220 billion over the next 5 years, making it one of the legislation's costliest programs. The measure also would finance a new requirement for 4 weeks of paid family leave and create temporary work permits so millions of immigrants could remain in the U.S. up to a decade. Both face an uncertain fate in the Senate. That chamber's 50-50 split, plus solid GOP opposition, gives every Democrat veto power. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, who helped slash the bill's 10-year cost from its earlier $3.5 trillion, has opposed the family leave provision, and the Senate parliamentarian enforces rules that make it hard to include policy-heavy provisions, such as immigration law changes. The bill would worsen projected budget deficits, already huge, by $160 billion over the coming decade. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that would be higher except for the $200 billion in projected extra tax collections by bolstering IRS spending for audits largely of the rich. Both parties worry about deficits selectively. Republicans passed tax cuts in 2017 that worsened red ink by $1.9 trillion, while Democrats enacted a COVID-19 relief bill this year with that same price tag. Representative Jared Golden of Maine, one of Congress's more conservative Democrats, was the only no vote from his party. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan organization favoring fiscal constraint, estimated the bill would cost nearly $5 trillion if Democrats hadn't made some provisions temporary to be more affordable. For instance, tax credits for children are extended for just 1 year, even though Democrats would make them permanent if they could. Panel votes 10-6, board to scrap sex offender for new term, by Alex Burness. The Denver Post. Colorado's Sex Offender Management Board plans to no longer recognize the term sex offender in its own guiding principles and policies. The board, which controls treatment standards for people already convicted of sex crimes, voted 10-6 Friday on a controversial proposal to replace sex offender with adults who commit sexual offenses. Board members weren't in lockstep on the issue and voted even more narrowly, 8-7 this year, to consider the language change in the first place. The board's Friday decision is now subject to a 20-day public comment period before final ratification by the board, a spokeswoman said. The argument for new language is based around an increasingly popular theory of person-first terminology. Labeling someone a sex offender, supporters of this change say, can impede rehabilitation efforts by creating the permanent perception that the person in question is a danger to public safety. That's precisely the point, said opponents of this change. Jessica Dotter, sexual assault resource prosecutor for the Colorado District Attorney's Council and a member of SOMB, said before Tuesday's vote that the new terminology, adults who commit sexual offenses, fails to convey or represent any sort of victim-centeredness. Dotter said victims of sexual abuse want their offender to be held accountable and to be known as an offender. Several law enforcement leaders, including Colorado Springs District Attorney Michael Allen, backed her up on that. The language change doesn't affect the state's sex offender registry either in name or in policy. What happened Friday is a symbolic shift more than anything. But Sexual Offender Management Board Chief Kimberly Klein told reporters this week it's the kind of change that could affect actual behavior. If we are talking about how someone speaks about themselves, that can increase risk, she said. Ultimately, it is victim-centered if we're reducing risk. Ironically, the Sex Offender Management Board will not change its name even as it renounces sex offender as outdated language. That name is determined by state statute and thus up to the legislature. Biden mulls reversing rules on western grouse species. By Matthew Brown, The Associated Press. Billings, Montana. The Biden administration on Friday said it will consider new measures to protect greater sage grouse, a bird species once found across much of the U.S. West that has suffered drastic declines in recent decades because of oil and gas drilling, grazing, wildfires, and other pressures. The announcement of a range-wide evaluation of habitat plans for greater sage grouse came after the Trump administration tried to scale back conservation efforts adopted when Biden was vice president in 2015. A federal court blocked Trump's changes, but Biden administration officials said the attempt set back conservation efforts, even as the chicken-sized birds' habitat was further ravaged by wildfires, invasive plants, and continued development. Republican-run states and industries that profit off public lands have clashed with wildlife advocates over how much space the birds need to survive. Some environmentalists insisted that the 2015 plans didn't go far enough because of loopholes that allowed grazing and drilling on land that sage grouse need. Biologists say wide buffers from drilling and other activities are needed to protect sage grouse breeding areas where birds engage in elaborate annual mating rituals. Bureau of Land Management Deputy Director Nada Culver said everything's on the table as the agency launches its evaluation of sage grouse habitat with no set deadlines for action. From changes to the buffers, to how we manage energy development, to how we manage every other activity, we are evaluating it, and we are looking for input on what are the most important things to look at, Culver said. Officials also will look at how climate change is adding to pressures on sage grouse. Culver pointed to data showing wildfires burned almost 10,700 square miles of the bird's habitat since 2016. The vast majority of the fires were on federal lands. Greater sage grouse once numbered in the millions across all or portions of 11 western states. Populations have dropped 65% since 1986, government scientists recently concluded. In 2010, wildlife officials said drastic habitat losses meant protections for sage grouse had become warranted under the Endangered Species Act. However, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did not take any action at the time, saying other species took priority. In 2015, the Wildlife Service determined protections were no longer needed after other federal and state officials adopted sweeping land management plans meant to halt or reverse the species' decline. The plans were billed as a compromise, but some components unraveled after Trump took office in 2017, and states sought changes to the documents that critics said would hurt grouse. The corky birds with long pointed tail feathers are known for their elaborate courtship display, in which male birds puff up air sacs in their chests to make an odd popping sound. Kathleen Sagama with the Western Energy Alliance, a group that represents oil and gas companies, said Friday's move by the administration was expected. Sage grouse has been a political football for decades, she said, adding that Democratic administrations have used the bird to block access to what her association views as productive uses of public lands. Federal officials said in May, in response to a court order, that they would consider a ban on new mining on large areas of public land to help the birds. A ban that officials sought to impose under former President Barack Obama was dropped by the Trump administration. The affected lands totaled 10 million acres in Idaho, Nevada, Montana, Oregon, Utah, and Wyoming. The Land Bureau has resumed that process. It will consider the original proposal and additional options, spokesperson Elise Sharp said. The order to take a new look at mining came in a lawsuit from environmentalists pending before the U.S. District Judge B. Lynn Windmill in Idaho. The judge faulted the Trump administration for ignoring prior science on the issue. Eric Mulvar, with Western Watersheds Project, the lead plaintiff in the case, said falling back on the Obama-era management plans would not be enough to protect the grouse. The plans made it too easy for oil companies and ranchers to disturb the birds' sagebrush habitat, he said. Denver Public Schools, nearly all staff members are vaccinated. By Melanie Osmar, Chalkbeat, Colorado. Nearly all Denver Public Schools employees have been vaccinated after a mandate from the city. Superintendent Alex Marrero said Thursday that 99.1% of the district's more than 13,700 employees had complied with the city health order to get the COVID-19 shots or an exemption. But 108 employees are set to lose their jobs January 2nd if they don't get vaccinated or obtain an exemption before then. The school board on Thursday formally terminated the employees, but left open a window for them to get vaccinated and keep their jobs. Data shared with the school board show that as of November 8th, fewer than 4% of employees had been granted a religious or medical exemption. The 108 non-compliant employees include 34 paraprofessionals, 12 food service workers, 11 custodians, and 11 transportation workers, according to a list provided by the district. They also include 6 members of the teachers' union, whose members are classroom teachers, school counselors, career and technical instructors, and others. Chalkbeat, Colorado is a nonprofit news organization covering education issues. Attorney likens Arbery rally to lynching of defendants. By Russ Bynum, The Associated Press, Brunswick, Georgia. The defense attorney who caused an outcry by saying black pastors should be barred from the murder trial over Ahmaud Arbery's death declared in court Friday that a courthouse rally supporting the slain black man's family was comparable to a public lynching of the 3 white defendants. This case has been infected by things that have nothing to do with the guilt or innocence of these defendants, attorney Kevin Goff told the judge, arguing that civil rights activists are trying to influence the disproportionately white jury. Goff renewed a request for a mistrial the day after the Reverend Al Sharpton, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and Martin Luther King III joined hundreds of pastors, most of them black, praying and rallying at the steps of the Glynn County Courthouse. The event was organized after Goff last week objected to Sharpton sitting in the back row of the courtroom with Arbery's parents. This is what a public lynching looks like in the 21st century, Goff told the judge, saying his client's right to a fair trial was being violated by a left woke mob. Superior Court Judge Timothy Walmsley dismissed the mistrial motion with little discussion. I don't recall any disruption in the courtroom itself, the judge said of Thursday's rally, which coincided with defense testimony. Goff is the lead attorney for William Roddy Bryan, who joined father and son Greg and Travis McMichael in pursuing Arbery in pickups after spotting the 25-year-old man running in their coastal Georgia neighborhood on February 23, 2020. Bryan took cell phone video of Travis McMichael shooting Arbery as he threw punches and grabbed for the shotgun. Arbery's killing later became part of the broader reckoning on racial injustice in the criminal legal system after a string of fatal encounters between black people and police. Goff repeatedly has raised concerns about outside activists seeking to influence the case. He made the lynching remark after prosecutor Linda Donikoski accused Goff of intentionally provoking outrage among black pastors and civil rights activists. They are responding to what he strategically, knowingly, intelligently did so that there would be a response so that he could then complain of it, Dunikoski said. That is good lawyering right there, because now he's motioned for a mistrial based on something that he caused. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, called Goss' latest comments ridiculous. He's done things repeatedly that just surprised me that he would say, she told reporters outside the courthouse. Very surprising, but not unexpected, I would say. With closing arguments set for Monday, prosecutors and defense attorneys spent Friday debating nuances of the legal instructions the judge plans to give the jury before deliberations. Much of the debate dealt with how the judge will describe the limitations on making a citizen's arrest. Defense attorneys say Georgia law authorized the McMichaels and Bryan to detain Arbery for police because they had valid reason to suspect he was a burglar. Prosecutors said there's no evidence that Arbery had committed any crimes in the neighborhood. Defense attorneys objected when the judge said he would instruct the jury that a private citizen's warrantless arrest must occur immediately after the perpetration of the offense, or, in the case of a felony, during escape. Robert Rubin, an attorney for Travis McMichael, said the proposed language would make it virtually impossible for a jury to find the defendants had probable cause to detain Arbery based on suspicion he had committed prior burglaries in the same home under construction he was seen running from before his death. We have built this whole case around the probable cause that Travis McMichael and Greg McMichael had on February 23rd for events that happened previously, Rubin said, and you are gutting all of it. Travis McMichael testified this week that he had seen security camera videos of Arbery inside the unfinished home and that he spotted Arbery creeping outside of it 12 days before the shooting. None of the five videos of Arbery inside the home showed him stealing. The owner said he installed cameras after items were taken from a boat he kept in an open garage. Walmsley said he would consider changes if attorneys could support them, citing other cases. Virginia, Unite the Right trial jury hears closing arguments. By Dennis Lavoie, The Associated Press. Charlottesville, Virginia. White nationalists planned, executed, and then celebrated racially motivated violence that killed one counter-protester and injured dozens. Lawyers for nine people hurt during the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville said Thursday, as they urged jurors to hold some of the country's most well-known white supremacists accountable. Their closing arguments in U.S. District Court in Charlottesville came in the trial over a lawsuit alleging that two dozen white nationalists, neo-Nazis, and white supremacist organizations conspired to commit violence during 2 days of demonstrations. Attorneys for the plaintiffs showed the jury dozens of text messages, chat room exchanges, and social media postings by the rally's main planners, including some peppered with racial epithets and talk of cracking skulls of anti-racist counter-protesters. We sued the people who were responsible, the leaders, the promoters, the group leaders, the people who brought the army, the people who were the most violent members of the army. Those are the people who we ask you to hold accountable today, said attorney Karen Dunn. Hundreds of white nationalists descended on Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th, 2017, ostensibly to protest the city's plans to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. During a march on the University of Virginia campus, white nationalists surrounded counter-protesters, shouted, "Jews will not replace us," and threw burning tiki torches at them. The next day, an avowed admirer of Adolf Hitler rammed his car into a crowd, killing a woman and injuring others. James Alex Fields, Jr. of Maumee, Ohio, is serving life in prison for murder and hate crimes for the car attack. He is named as a defendant in the lawsuit, which seeks monetary damages and a judgment that the defendants violated the plaintiff's constitutional rights. Other defendants used their closing arguments to distance themselves from Fields. Their attorneys told jurors that the injuries suffered by the plaintiffs do not prove that the defendants entered into a conspiracy to commit violence. Attorney James Kolnick, who represents Jason Kessler, the lead organizer of the rally, and two other defendants, said the plaintiffs' lawyers have shown the defendants said ridiculous and offensive things but have not proven a conspiracy. They've proven to you that the alt-right is the alt-right. They're racists. They're anti-Semites. No kidding. You knew that when you walked in here, Kolnick said. What does that do to prove a conspiracy? He said. Kolnick said that when the defendants talked about violence before the rally, they were referring to fist fights, pushing and shoving, not plowing into a crowd with a car. None of these defendants could have foreseen what James Fields did, Kolnick said. Richard Spencer, a white nationalist who coined the term alt-right and represented himself at trial, told the jury he had no role in planning the events and did not commit acts of violence. Plaintiff's lawyers have portrayed Spencer as the leader of the torch rally. The last thing in the world that I wanted by agreeing to speak at Unite the Right was an event that became a catastrophe, that involved the tragic death of a young woman, that involved the injuries to the plaintiffs, and that will forever remain a stain on the cause that I sincerely believe in, Spencer said. Spencer also reminded the jury about controversial comments then-President Donald Trump made after the rally when he failed to denounce the white nationalists and said there were fine people on both sides. That drew a warning from Judge Norman Moon, who said Trump's remarks were not evidence in the case and could not be used. Spencer was warned again by the judge when he began to talk about Jesus, describing him as a radical who was executed for his views. Spencer turned again to the jury. Your task, and it's a difficult one, is to apply the law fairly and precisely, even to those who you might despise. Lawyers for the defendants have argued there was no conspiracy and their use of racial epithets and that their blustery talk in chat rooms before the rally is protected by the First Amendment. Several defendants have testified that they resorted to violence only after they or their associates were attacked. They've blamed the violence on anti-fascist protesters known as Antifa and also each other. According to CNN, the jury finished its first day of deliberations without reaching a verdict. Moon sent jurors home and told them to come back Monday. Roberta Kaplan, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, told jurors that if they find the defendants liable for the violence, it is up to them how much to award in damages. She suggested a range of $7 million to $10 million for each of the four plaintiffs who were injured in the car attack and $3 million to $5 million for plaintiffs physically harmed in street clashes or emotionally injured by witnessing the violence. Kaplan did not suggest a specific range for punitive damages. Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. Colorado hiring revs up again. Previously reported job gains also have been revised higher by Aldo Svaldi. The Denver Post. Colorado's economy posted strong job gains in October with lackluster gains for September revised significantly higher, a sign that growth in the state continues to chug forward despite a rising tide of COVID-19 cases, inflationary pressures, and other concerns, according to an update Friday from the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. Employers in the state added 10,600 non-farm payroll jobs from September to October, with the private sector adding 10,000 of those jobs and the public sector adding 600, according to a survey of business establishments. Gains for September, which initially came in at a lackluster 5,100 jobs, were revised higher to a monthly gain of 9,700 jobs, mirroring strong upward revisions made nationally. What we originally had reported as pretty weak gains in the U.S. in terms of employment change for August and September now look pretty decent, said Ryan Gedney, a senior labor economist with the department during a news briefing Friday morning. Employment in the state, which is measured from a separate household survey that includes the self-employed, rose by 11,900 last month, surpassing the gain of 3,400 in the state's labor force. The state's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate fell from 5.6% in September to 5.4% in October as more unemployed workers found jobs. Leisure and hospitality is the top sector hiring in Colorado this year, accounting for about 64% of the jobs gained in 2021, Gedney said. Last month, of the 10,600 jobs added, 5,100 were at hotels and food service providers and 1,700 at arts, entertainment, and recreation establishments. But the recovery is lumpy elsewhere, with mining and logging, which covers oil and gas production, information and other services, a broad catch-all category, registering monthly declines in October. Construction firms have shed 1,200 jobs over the past year, despite a backlog of projects to complete. The share of Coloradans participating in the labor force held at 68.2%, which is the fourth highest rate in the country. One reason the state's unemployment rate ranks 31st among all states is that more Colorado residents are actively working or looking for work, Gedney said. Colorado has recovered about 87% of the private sector jobs lost in March and April of last year, ahead of the 85% recovery seen nationally, Gedney said. Colorado Springs is the first and only metro area in the state to surpass its pre-pandemic job counts at 102%, while Denver is matching the state recovery rate. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, November 20th, 2021 Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County won some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We got the Hispanics coming on our side, African Americans coming on our side. We're taking down the Biden regime.
Former Trump White House strategist Steve Bannon spoke as he surrendered to law enforcement Monday, appearing for a hearing after being indicted by a grand jury for defying a congressional subpoena. Bannon faces 2 charges of contempt of Congress for failing to appear for deposition before the January 6 committee and for refusing to provide documents to the panel. Former Democratic Texas State Representative Beto O'Rourke announced he will run for governor of the Lone Star State. In a fundraising email to supporters, he touted himself as a unity candidate. Here's O'Rourke criticizing Republican lawmakers.
They're focusing on the kind of extremist policies around abortion or permitless carry or even in our schools that really only divide us.
Democratic Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, the longest-serving active member of the U.S. Senate, announced he'll retire after 8 terms. His last expected day is January 2, 2023. At a press conference, Leahy reflected on his career, which began when he was elected to the Senate in 1974.
And within just a few months of taking office, as the newest and by far most junior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, we were asked to vote to reauthorize and to continue the war in Vietnam.
President Biden signed an executive order addressing violence against indigenous communities, particularly women. It directs the Departments of Justice, Interior, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services to create a strategy to improve public safety and justice for Native Americans. President of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians, Shannon Hosley, spoke Monday during a White House virtual summit with tribal leaders.
Tribal sovereignty and self-governance, as well as honoring the federal trust responsibility to tribal nations, should be the cornerstone of federal Indian policy.
Biden also signed the infrastructure bill and tapped former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu to coordinate implementation of the $1.2 trillion bipartisan legislation. Meanwhile, at the White House late Monday, President Biden met virtually with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The two leaders discussed trade, military aggression, and human rights. Finally, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, lawyers delivered closing arguments Monday in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the teenage gunman who fatally shot 2 people and wounded a third during protests last year over police brutality. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado would like to acknowledge the generous contributions of the AEC Trust. Thank you for your support. If you have questions about our many audio information services, please call us at 303-786-7777. Look us up online at aincolorado.org. Thank you for listening.